or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by Charles Stevenson, author of The Beat, Go-Go Music from Washington, D.C. We'll also be joined by Director of Information Collection at EPA's Office of Environmental Information, Lisa Schlosser, and First Command District Advisor, Bob Hill. Welcome to Inside Government.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me here.
So let's start off by telling us what go-go music is.
Let me first correct one thing. I am a co-author of The Beat. Kip Lornell is the other co-author. I'll make sure I get that in because I know Kip, but probably listening.
So tell us a little about go-go music. What is it?
Well, right now, go-go music is the heartbeat of Washington, D.C. It's the cultural expression that musicians developed in Washington about three, four decades ago. It's a offspring, obviously, of R&B music, and it's Washington, D.C.'s signature sound as it relates to popular music.
It's been around for three or four decades. How did it get created?
Well, that's a long, long story. So I'll kind of shorten it for you. Washington, D.C., as you know, in the 40s, 50s, was a segregated city. And so in terms socially, what the black community would do is congregate in a lot of these cabaret halls around Washington, D.C. A lot of them were owned by Catholic churches, the Panorama Room, Northeast Guards, Masonic Temple, etc. And they would have live bands who would perform at these functions, cabarets we used to call them. And as a result, the music got to be, very popular. And it extended to the weeks. So from the weekends, the functions were also held during the week. Smokey Robinson penned this tune, Going to a Go-Go, years ago. And what happened in Washington is people in Washington took that tag and tagged it on to the dance hall. So going to the go-go meant going to the dance. Later on, Chuck Brown developed the music or a beat that was then called go-go music. And so that's the short version of how it developed.
And how is that beat different from, say, normal rhythm and blues?
Well, it changed from time to time. But when Chuck first developed it, it was a little slower. And he got the beat, really, he says, from one of Grover Washington's songs. And so it's a slowed down, very funky. And I'm not a musician, so I can't give you the time. So I'm not going to get it strung out. But it was a slower version of an R&B beat that we knew back in the 60s and early 70s. And he just slowed it down and made it more funkier and added percussion. And so the percussion was added to it. And then along with the percussion was the whole call and response, which was taken from the black churches and actually has links way back to African music, call and response.
And so when Chuck Brown really got it going, you'd say that was probably in the early 70s, maybe?
Yeah, and what happened is it was right around the advent of disco music. And people would go to these go-go's now the term to go into a dance is going to a go-go. And when people went, they wanted to dance all night long. And so what Chuck developed was a means of keeping people on the dance floor. Because then when disco started to come in, it was replacing some of these bands because people were coming to these functions and they just wanted to dance. And so bands had to develop a means of keeping their audiences on the dance floor. And Chuck was a pioneer in that. He just kept his beat going. He would do a tune and his drummer would continue to play and he would play into the next song. And so if you were on the dance floor, you could be virtually on the dance floor for an hour, hour and a half, nonstop.
With functionally the same song?
Well, no, he would change it. He would go in and out of different songs, but the beat would remain constant. So he would finish a song, and Kim Boy or whoever was playing his drums at that point in time, would keep the beat going. And then they would go into another song. Before you even knew it, you would dance it to another song. So you would dance a whole hour and a half but without a break.
So the musicians were playing the whole hour and a half.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that'd be rough on a musician.
Oh, but they loved it. Yeah, that's what they did. Yeah, I mean, as I say, you know, Go-Go kept going and going and going. Yeah. Yeah.
And the audience, this obviously is participation. I mean, you're not going to the symphony.
Right. No, no. Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing that's very interesting about this music, because it focuses on the audience. I mean, it doesn't work unless the audience participates. And so how bands get the audience to participate is by giving what they call shout outs, you know, recognizing their person, recognizing that they're in the house, as they would say, recognizing that their neighborhoods are there, recognizing birthdays, and just talking about whatever the latest fad, the latest, whether or not it's the Skins or whatever, you know, the Bullets or the Washington Wizards. I mean, so they would keep those kinds of things going on, and you would have a lot of call and response from the audience.
Now, this was unique to Washington. This wasn't going on in other places?
Correct. And it's funny because it kind of developed almost simultaneous to hip-hop, but on a different track. And obviously down through the years, there has been some influence of hip-hop on Go-Go, but Go-Go basically developed on its own. And again, it started because of the live self-contained bands who were basically doing cover tunes in these dance halls. And that's where people would congregate in these dance halls, the Panorama Room, Northeast Gardens, whatever. And it just kept constant. And it just kept developing up to now. I mean, now the same situation exists. You still have bands who play in these different function halls around the city and around Prince George's County and parts of Virginia. So yes, the music and the culture is really distinct to Washington.
Now, was there a heavy emphasis on lyrics in go-go music, or is it really more instrumental?
It's kind of to go hand in hand. The lyrics, again, talks more about, you know, contemporary happenings, whatever's going on. And they would take a little phrase like Junkyard Band has like the hee-haw, and you have to really be part of what's going on to understand what they're talking about. And it would take a dance, like EU had a phrase called the EU freeze. So the lyrics really kept on what was going on in the community. The music, again, was always constant because it was always highly, how can I say, you know, again, infused with the drums and the percussion, the horns, and it was just a very lively, upbeat music that just kept, once you came in, it was infectious. You could not stay still.
Now, you mentioned the EU. Most of our listeners might be thinking that's the European Union. So what was the EU and what was your involvement
EU
in that?
EU was Experience Unlimited. That's a good question. EU was Experience Unlimited. And that's how I got involved. I was the original manager of Experience Unlimited. And they reached a lot of acclaim when they recorded Doing the Butt. That was a international hit with Spike Lee in School Days. So yeah, EU is still playing, by the way, led by Sugar Bear Gregory Elliott.
And that's a DC
based group. Yeah.
And has there been much growth outside of DC of Go-Go?
Well, aside from EU, you know, Trouble Funk, periodically Rare Essence, and of course, Chuck Brown. I mean, Chuck Brown is our ambassador. I mean, Chuck Brown plays internationally. Chuck Brown plays in festivals around the country. Whenever he has a new CD, it's a national release. So Chuck Brown is it for us. Now, there has been another band called Mumble Sauce, which kind of, When they came out on the national scene, they kind of bypassed the local market, if you will, and they went straight to national. And now they still see themselves as going in that direction. And what they're trying to do is take the music, you know, more national, international. And what I think about that is, in order to create a DC sound, you're going to need at least 3-4 groups to join Mumble Sauce. So hopefully we'll see what happens with them.
Now, let's talk a little about the book. Why did you write your book?
Well, because Kipper and I thought that it was very important to document the history and the development of go-go music because, again, I mean, the music is aligned with the social interaction of this city. I mean, I went back to when the town was segregated and how, you know, African Americans in this town had to develop their own social means. As a result, go-go and the music became a means of employment, a means of just people enjoying themselves. And we wanted to document that. Also, if you people don't even really maybe not realize this, but in the early 70s, when they had Summer in the Parks and the D.C. Department of Recreation was very vibrant, they worked with a lot of these bands and they helped to push out and help to market go-go music. So they were basically complicit, as was the D.C. public school system when they had strong music departments. Because a lot of these musicians went through the D.C. public schools, and that's where they honed their skills were in schools. And so after you learn how to play your guitar, your horn, you wanted to play. And the D.C. Republic Recreation had this big band, which was called the Ambassadors. And if you were in school, you wanted to play in the big band called the Ambassadors. And once you did, if you were good enough to get into the Ambassadors, then a lot of guys, what they did, went out and formed their own neighborhood groups. You know, whether or not they were the Aggression, the 100 Years Time, Experience Unlimited, whatever, Leadhead. So it led to that. And so it just started growing like wildfire. So there is a marriage in terms of development of go-go with the city, the school system, and just, you know, the vibe, the spirit of the musicians, how they took it and made sure that it went on and on and on.
Now, let me ask you a little about some of the instruments. When I was reading through the book, there was a portion in there that reminded me. I remember going to Redskin games as a kid and seeing the guys outside drumming on the plastic.
Yeah.
Was that part of that?
Yeah. That led to what we call the junkyard era. So there was a junkyard band. Actually, junkyard band started playing on plastic drums and what have you because they couldn't afford the real thing. And that's how junkyard started. So they started a craze in Washington where now you have people who play on these plastic, you know, drums or whatever. But again, it was started by a junkyard band, and they started a group because they could not afford traditional instruments.
And that almost mirrors when people think of like the steel drum music. The reason why people were playing on steel drums is they were abandoned trash.
Yeah.
That basically people couldn't afford drums.
A lot of connections there. A lot of connections. How people had to just do what they had. They had to do with what they had to in front of them in order to create, because they wanted to create music. You know, the junkyard band started in Barry Farms. And they watched the Chuck Browns, the Red S's. And again, these kids could not afford the could not afford the instruments, but they wanted to play. And Lord, it was so great because when they got started, it was so good that eventually they got the instruments. And now Junkyard Band is a household name.
Now, as we get started on this and we come down to our last about minute of this segment, let's talk a little directly about Chuck's influence on you. Where did you first meet Chuck Brown?
I first met Chuck probably in 1971. He gave Experience Unlimited their first big break to open up for the Soul Searchers at the Panorama Room. And I'll never forget that. I mean, Chuck is really, we say he's the godfather of go-go. That's for real. I mean, he's not only the godfather of go-go, he's really the godfather of Washington, D.C., because he's raised so many people in this town. And so he and I have remained friends. I mean, it's almost, I hate to say, I shouldn't hate. It's great. I've known him almost 40 years, a long, long time. And he's been the consummate gentleman, professional, and he's just a good person to know.
We're going to continue with that, but we're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFG's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances. Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. Purchase any laptop from July 15th through August 15th and receive a free custom skin. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
AFGE members are eligible for a 6% members only discount.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Charles Stevenson, co-author of The Beat, Go-Go Music from Washington, D.C. Welcome back.
Thank you.
We went to the break about Chuck Brown, the godfather of Go-Go Music. Tell us a little more about how he got it started.
Well, I wish he was here because, you know, Chuck, you know, served some time. I believe it was in Lawton, and that's where he learned how to better play the guitar. I think he was playing before he went in, and when he went in, he better mastered how to play. And then while he was in, he said, "I'm never coming back here again in life. You know, I'm gonna do my time. I'm never coming back." And he just perfected the ability to be an entertainer. And he came out. I'm probably skipping around, but before he started the Soul Searchers, he played with a group called the Los Latinos, which was a Latin-flavored band. And that band broke up, and then he started the Soul Searchers probably in the mid to late 60s. And they did more R&B covers. But what he did, he added the percussion to that. And from then on, it's just been straight ahead for Chuck. I mean, let me go back and say this, because he doesn't get enough acclaim. But, you know, he is a consummate band leader. I mean, Chuck has gone out and been able to get some of the best musicians in this area to join him. And he has the ability to mesh all that talent and form, I think, which has been the best band for like 30, 40 years in this town. So, I mean, he's taken a lot from Duke Ellington in terms of, you know, how to put together a band, how to master the sound, and how to stay on top. I mean, because there's been several changes in music since he started playing, and he always finds himself at the top.
And what are some of the other bands that I guess were around during the beginning and some of the more popular ones today?
Well, earlier on, you know, you had groups like The Aggression, 100 Years Time, Leadhead, 95th Congress. Oh my God. I mean, there's just a lot of bands. Black Heat, the Young Senators, which I must talk about. The Young Senators probably were the most popular band in the early 70s. And what happened is they left town to back up Eddie Kendricks, who was a singer with the Temptations. Without a doubt, I mean, the Young Senators were the best, most popular band in Washington. But when they left, it was left to Chuck Brown, The Aggression, and Scasey and the Sound Service. And Chuck just beat them all out. And he got the number one rating, and he stayed there ever since. So those were those are the pioneers. And after them came like Experience Limited, Trouble Funk, Rare Essence, Junkyard, Backyard, and all that. Now you have groups like TCB, UCB, Familiar Faces, Vibe. These are the more popular bands. And since the music's been around for so long, you kind of have subgroups. Because now there's gospel go-go. You have what you call grown and sexy groups. So Subtle Thoughts, if you want to go, you know, more middle age, I mean, in 30s. So Subtle Thoughts attracts that audience. Rare Essence still attracts a more younger audience, but not as young as, say, let's say, a Backyard or a TCB. So you can pick and choose, you know, what, I guess what flavor of go-go you want to taste at that point in time. And all the way to jazz. I mean, so you have groups now that have more of a jazz, sound. So it's interesting. Now, the most popular, segment, I think, of go-go is what they call bounce. And that's what the younger bands play, you know, TCB, UCB, and some others. You know, they play the bounce beat, which is faster than the traditional go-go beat. Now, some say that it mirrors the old 50s R&B beats. So it's interesting, but, you know, they're still playing. They call it the bounce beat, and it's very, very popular right now. So you have that. But that focuses really on a whole nother generation.
And are you finding that there's things that influenced go-go from the beginning? I mean, you mentioned R&B, but I mean, when people talk old school, I think a Lead Belly is old school, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when EU first started, people don't know this, but EU first started, they really wanted to be a rock band. I mean, they were playing Grand Funk. I mean, Stairway to Heaven. I mean, that's really what they were focusing on. And then it came, you know, no, it really wasn't a market in the community for what you were playing. So you had to really adapt. So they went more to the R&B. And then Chuck, you know, is more of a blues, jazz bass. If you listen to hit what he does, and Rare Essence has always been more R&B. So although they play go-go bands through the, and Trouble Funk was really more of the funkier, you know, heavy type sound, all the bands had different emphasis, you know. And so, so they did take from, you know, a lot of the popular music that was in existence, and they learned. I think that back when we had a lot of these self-contained bands, a lot of them would pattern themselves after the Earth, Wind & Fires, the Man Drills, a lot of other self-contained groups that were national at the time. So there were a lot of, we'd do a lot of their cover tunes, and a lot of the personnel would be basically the same. But the difference here was, as time went on, was actually the beat. So after Earth, Wind & Fire and War began to lose influence, again, going back to the advent of disco, because disco pushed out a lot of those bands, then the go-go beat really, you know, was established and kind of survived from then on. Yeah. And as hip-hop developed, we took some points from them, you know. Go-go bands have what they call lead talkers opposed to lead rappers, you know, and a talker basically just sets the tone. You know, the talker really controls. He's more like a George Clinton. George Clinton wasn't a rapper. He was a talker. So James Funk of Rare Essence really was the first to really, you know, refine the role of a talker, which really was to control to the audience, to make sure you get everybody involved, and just to set the pace for the evening.
Now, as we move forward with that, obviously go-go began before rap.
Yeah.
It was pre-rap, mm-hmm. and really pre-hip-hop. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they built on things from go-go? Are there specific singers or bands that were influenced by go-go
that are
clear?
There were some. I mean, Curtis Blow. I'll never forget, we did a show with Curtis Blow here, EU, in the mid-70s. We were at the D.C. Coliseum, and I think Curtis was supposed to close the show, and Rare Essence and Trouble Funk were on the show, and he saw what was going on, and Curtis Blow came out, came out of the dressing room and said, "Wait a minute, can we flip this? Will you guys allow me to come on before you, and then, you know, y'all close the show?" Because he knew that there was no way he can come on after Rare Essence, Trouble, and EU at the time. That set up a situation for us to go in and record Party Time with Curtis Blow, which became a national hit. And then there were other bands. Rare Essence did things with Dougie Fresh. And so there were other rappers that did tunes with go-go musicians. And still to the day, I mean, Jill Scott, I mean, she did, you know, a go-go tune. And then Nas, and there's some others that have done recently, have done go-go backed, you know, tunes.
So when you go out, who do you like to go and see? Or who have you enjoyed the most?
Well, I still enjoy Chuck. I still enjoy Chuck. Of course, now when it comes to my most popular group, I like, you know, Santana. I mean, so, you know, it is, you know, it spans. But if we're going out locally, it's probably Chuck.
And Chuck Brown. What are some of your favorite venues in the D.C. area over the years?
Over the years, you know, is, you know, Blues Alley, because, you know, it's a nice room to hear. Constitution Halls sometimes, because it's not too big and not too small. And then again, I mean, over the years, all the the venues have changed. So, you know, those are the ones that are still kind of around.
But how about from the early days? Were there any places that are really special in your mind?
Well, the Panorama Room in Southeast Washington, because that's really where we got our start. And it was a dance hall that, you know, was right in Southeast. And every Tuesday we would play and we would get remarkable crowds and just had a great time. So the Panorama Room, if one were to go down, it would be the Panorama Room for me.
Now, as I think of other genres, I think of like Zydeco, and you know, you can go to New Orleans and go to Jazz Fest, and if you can't find some good Zydeco there, you can't find it anywhere.
Right.
If you were looking to go to a festival kind of thing, does D.C. have anything where it really showcases the go-go?
Well, it changes periodically. So there's not, it used to be like a Malcolm X Day celebration we used to have that ran in Washington for over 25 years. So you knew that once a year you could go there. And now I don't think that there is an annual festival now that, you know, promotes go-go music for various reasons. So.
And how has the district changed over the years with go-go? I mean, you talk about how it was the schools were really helping to kind of promote it and that kind of thing. Do you think that that's still there in some areas?
Well, I think it's not there the way it used to be because of the schools now don't play the role they used to do. Used to play because of, you know, budget concerns. But and that's one reason why the second edition of this book we wrote, because we want to get this book into the D.C. public schools. So currently we're working with the school system and Teaching for Change to develop a curriculum to get the book into the D.C. public schools, because we think it's important to share the history of go-go music with the young people in Washington, D.C. so they understand how this music developed. So right now we're right in the midst of doing this. So anyway, I'm going to just take this opportunity to let your listeners know that we are soliciting support, both monetarily and if people have expertise that they want to lend to our effort, we accept that too. And we have a website. It's www.thebeatisgogo.com. So if you really want to help us out, you know, you can go to our website and help us out. So it's thebeatisgogo.com.
And particularly for people that aren't real familiar with it, how would you differentiate go-go music from rap music?
Well, go-go music is live instruments. I mean, you got live musicians. I mean, there's no turntables. It's drums, it's guitars, it's pianos, it's horns. I mean, that's really the biggest. I mean, aside from maybe the Roots, there are not too many hip-hop groups that premiere themselves, promote, you know, live musicians. I mean, so most rappers, you know, it's turntables. It's so funny. We used to do shows with some of these rappers, like in right here, and they come here, and they were huge, you know, national stars, and they'd be on a show with us, and they might want to close. They might close the show, and the audience would leave. And sometimes we would just really feel bad for them, because it was no way that their sound could compare with what the bands were putting out, because the feeling, the emotion that you get from live instrumentation cannot be duplicated with a guy on a turntable, you know, with a mic in his hand. You know, you just can't duplicate it. And so the audiences here in Washington have been honed to live music. And I mean, rap and hip hop, you know, pretty popular nationally, but I don't think if you did some sort of poll here in Washington, it probably not as big here as they are in other cities around the country because of the influence of go-go music.
And as we come into our last minute, the future of go-go, do you see some younger folks coming into this? They're going to step up?
Again, I think so. I think like the Mumble Sauces, and I think there'll be some other groups that will, you know, follow them and try to do a more national, international. But let me just say this. We talked about Zydeco in New Orleans. I mean, I think go-go, again, and we'll stop with this, is the heartbeat of Washington, D.C. So there will always be go-go music, go-go groups, and go-go culture in Washington, D.C. It's just a matter of, you know, how big. But it's going to always be. It's not going anywhere. So I think the future for go-go is good. It really depends on how you judge success, because a lot of the musicians are very content on playing their music right here at home. And they really don't have dreams of going out nationally, internationally. So we'll see. I think the music is going to stay constant. It's going to be always good here, and hopefully there will be some other groups like Mambo Sauce that will try to spread the word around the world.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Up next, you'll hear Jason Fornicola's interviews with Lisa Schlosser and Bob Hill.
I'm joined by Lisa Schlosser, the Director of Office of Information Collection from the Office of Environmental Information and the Environmental Protection Agency. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Good, thanks. Appreciate it.
Now, this morning you were one of the keynote speakers here at the Excellence in Government Conference, and one of the things you were talking about was the importance of opening up government and sort of the release of information and some data sharing and things like that. Could you tell us a little bit about your role at EPA in opening up government a little bit?
Sure. So Jason, a couple things. So as an executive and as an employee at EPA, one of our core values within EPA is transparency. So in that way, we think about transparency in everything we do, and you know how information we have could be valuable to any of our stakeholders, whether it's an NGO or a state, anybody that might or a citizen that might use our data. So from just being an employee, I think about that in everything I do. But secondarily, I do chair the Open Government Work Group. So from that end, we do look at opportunities. We look at public input. We look at employee input. We have a site open where employees can come in and also make recommendations, you know, about how we can be more transparent, participatory, and collaborative.
How do these methods differ maybe a little bit from how things were done in the past?
I just think there's more of an emphasis, and again, you know, within EPA, we've operated on this this notion, this concept of community right to know for many, many, many years. So within EPA, it's pretty much a way of doing business, but with the new directive, there's even an underscore, I think, to the importance of getting data out and, you know, letting the public use it, and also having the public take this data and present it in ways that maybe we hadn't thought of from a government perspective that might be beneficial to our core mission of protecting health and humans and the environment.
Now, when you are opening up this data and sort of becoming more transparent, there must be some challenges along the way in doing this. Could you talk a little bit about some of the challenges you face just in taking on such an enormous project?
Yeah, a couple things. It's just the sheer volume of responses that we get in from, again, both our employees as well as those in the public and external to EPA. We have learned that we do have to set up a good process to be responsive, but also to manage expectations. But from a government-wide perspective, we do have an obligation of privacy. We have an obligation for national security. And we also have an obligation to protect confidential business information that we might have. So we have to kind of balance transparency and openness with protecting data that does need to be protected and where there's an expectation of protecting that data.
Now, a couple of things that you discussed on the panel that were interesting, I think a lot of people would find valuable, some websites. One was the epa.gov/myenvironment website. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's actually a great site. I use it myself when I look at property or if I'm going to think about buying a house. And really, it's a great resource for any citizen to go to. So basically, you just enter in your zip code, and we search all of our databases across EPA and other databases, like we talked about with Todd, and pull up different kind of data for that particular zip code. And it's air quality. What's the air quality in that area? What's the cancer rates in that area? Are there any hazardous waste sites in that area that you should be aware of? So a variety of environmental and health data that will help you make a better informed decision about where you want to live and what's happening in your community.
Do you find that people give you feedback based on that data that maybe they didn't know about otherwise and thinking, oh, there might be something hazardous, a few miles from my house or something like that?
I haven't actually analyzed that aspect of it, but one of the parts of my environment also is what we call our shout-out feature. So if there's some great environmental initiative happening in your community or you're sponsoring in your community, you can go ahead and put the location of that particular event into the website, and it shows up on a map, so anybody can go in anytime and look at what's happening in their community. So from that aspect, we do get, pretty cool data back from the public that feeds into what we present on our site.
And something similar to that, I think that you had mentioned on data.gov, is the published toxic materials list. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we collect data from any entity, any regulated entity that emits toxic substances and into the air, into water, et cetera. We collect that data on an annual basis and the impacts of it. And so we've put that data out, and that data is used by a lot of folks to kind of analyze the environment, to write reports. So, for example, one newspaper, I can't recall which one it was, actually took that data and came up with and analyzed the data and came up with a list of the 10 most toxic cities in the United States and put that out. So, again, good data allows the public to make better informed decisions about where they want to live or what's happening in their community.
Absolutely. And to that end a little bit, how do you implement metrics into this to sort of find out how you're doing, not only long term, but just in the immediate, in the short term?
Yeah. So we have a web analytics. We have several tools that we do use. So we look to see what people are accessing, what kind of data that they're downloading. We do that within EPA, and we analyze those metrics really on a continuous basis, kind of go back and put more data out there if we see a trend. But also, data.gov analyzes kind of what type of data, what are the most popular downloads. And then the third thing that we do is we still have our collaboration site up and running, and we'll pose different questions to the public and say, we're thinking about doing this. What type of data would you like? Where are their data gaps? So those are three ways that we are continuously looking to see what the reaction is to what we've put out and what we should be putting out.
And when you talk about collaboration, obviously, you're collaborating in a number of different ways. One of them would be with other agencies. Mm-hmm. How do you find that relationship or those relationships coming along? People now probably being a little bit more open with their own information from agency to agency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think a great example is what Todd had mentioned during the presentation as well, and that is NOAA. I mean, weather data. So we incorporate weather data in a lot in everything we do. I mean, relative to the environment, we also work pretty closely with our state government and other partners to collect data and put that information out there as well.
And finally, one of the questions I think probably people would want to know is, how much does all of this cost? What's the impact in dollars, not only just now, but in the long term? Is it something that you think will save money? Will it cost more money? What's the outcome there?
I can't, we're still so early in this process, Jason. I can't make I can't give you a factual answer.
Sure.
Yet. However, a couple things. I think by putting this data out, we're going to see creative uses of the data, and we're also going to get feedback from the consumers of that data on what's good data, what's not good data. So, ultimately, I think we're going to create some efficiencies in what we do, and I think we're also going to be able to target what data we do need to be collecting and putting out to the public. So, you know, in the long run, hopefully create more efficiencies and cut costs by eliminating inefficient data collections or inefficient processes around data management.
Sure. And it sounds like such a great initiative and, you know, data sharing and opening up government and whatnot. So it's obviously a direction that we want to go in, of course, in terms of using technology to its fullest. Do you have any other projects that you can tell us about or anything that's coming up that we might be interested in or sharing with the audience?
We're looking at also putting in place a mobile app around my environment. So you'll actually be able to download an app where you can type in your zip code and kind of see what the environmental condition is. I would say that's one of the things. We have a WaterSense site that we just launched last week, in fact. And so you can go into this site. It's a web-based site right now. And you can go in and see kind of what products are out there. Where are their rebates for incorporating or purchasing, say faucets, for example, where you can get some water efficiencies and where there's rebates, and down to where you can purchase these items to help, you know, improve water conservation. So I'd look for that. That just came out last week, so we'll have updates on that activity as well as we go forward.
And if anyone wants to learn more about any of these initiatives that you've talked about today, where should they visit you?
EPA.gov/open. We keep current on all the different activities, and I'd encourage anyone to go there, or EPA.gov/myenvironment, where you can kind of get information about your particular community.
Great. Lisa Schlosser, Director of the Office of Information Collection, Office of Environmental Information for EPA, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it very much. Maybe one day you'll come back and see us again.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jason.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Are you an AFGE member who loves the great outdoors? Then the AFGE Union Sportsmen's Alliance benefit is perfect for you. Whether it's fins, furs, or feathers that calls you, the Union Sportsmen's Alliance has you covered. This unique benefit is a community of hunters and fishermen who share the Union Brotherhood. That's right, an exclusive hunting and fishing club by and for Union members, retirees, and their families. Your $25 membership gets you money-saving discounts on great outdoor gear and services, a free MyTopo.com online mapping subscription, a one-year subscription to a top outdoor magazine, and a $25 gift certificate for Beretta field gear. You'll also receive a subscription to the Union Sportsman's Journal. To learn more about this exciting benefit, please visit the member benefits page at afge.org or call us at 877-872-2211. That's 877-872-2211. Join today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined again by one of our favorites here on Inside Government, Bob Hill, the District Advisor for First Command. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Jason. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Now, the last time we had you here at the Excellence in Government Conference a few months ago, we were pretty optimistic. We were feeling good. The Dow was creeping just over 11,000. It looked like things were really on the rise. And then not long after that conversation, things really did take a turn for the worse. And it doesn't seem like we've really rebounded from that yet. In that short span of time, can you tell us maybe a couple of lessons that we've learned during that time?
I think some of the lessons that one can take from the recent experiences that we've in the economy and financial world is that there are a lot of things out there, Jason, that we just don't have control of. For example, we read and have seen a lot about problems in Europe and European economies such as Greece. We've had, regrettably, the experience in the Gulf and how that has impacted our whole way of thinking about the environment and the economy. My point being is that there are a lot of things that we just don't have control over, but they do affect us in one way or other. Mm-hmm. And the stock market slide, as you talked about, is one of those.
And so knowing that we don't have control over everything that impacts us in our situations, what are the things that people should be focusing on that they do have control over that could either keep them out of trouble during a difficult time or soften the blow a little bit?
I think it's important that all of us take a step back and look at our own financial situation. Mm-hmm. And that the first place I would go to do that is looking at our own budgets. Mm-hmm. And every month, it's important that we think about putting some money aside for the rainy days that we're all going to experience, or to pay for things that are going to come up. For example, we're only 5 months from the Christmas holidays and the end of the year. So if someone is thinking about how they want to prepare for the an expenditure or during that time frame, they ought to think about putting some money aside now. The same goes with making sure that you are paying down debt, because that, of course, is a problem with our country. But again, we don't have control over everything, but we do have control over our own financial situation. So I recommend to everyone to consider putting extra dollars toward paying down their debt, whether that's credit cards or just making sure that other expenditures have been taken care of. And the other thing, of course, for federal employees is to make sure that they are, in fact, contributing as much as they can and what budget will allow toward their thrift savings plan, because, again, that is one of those areas that you do have control over to a certain extent, because you will decide how much you're going to put aside for your financial future.
And as you have been talking with your clients over the last several months and years, are you finding a change in how people are doing things?
I think many of my clients, Jason, are more conservative in how they view their financial situation. They're not expecting a large rate of return. I think several years ago that was not the case. I think the expectations have been lowered. That doesn't mean, though, that you shouldn't continue to do the basics that are necessary to make sure that your future is a brighter one than it is today.
Do you, as a financial advisor, see challenges in communicating that message to your clients?
I think, Jason, one of the things I've seen is that with working with younger federal employees, and we have many of them who have become clients, they have a lot of distractions, a lot of places where their dollars can go. And I can appreciate the fact that you're starting out your life and you need to take care of some basics. But what a great opportunity that younger federal employees have to plan for the future. Time is on their side, and time is critical if you're thinking long term. And again, back to thrift savings plan, the opportunity to invest for 20 or 30 or more years gives you a great advantage, because there's no doubt we're going to have more economic unrest or ups and downs, if you will, in the future. And so just putting aside money now toward your retirement is a very smart idea, a long-term idea, but a very smart one, because, again, you're taking control of your financial future, and I think in the long run you'll be glad that you did.
And if you could, for a minute, talk about the importance of not just, of course, the younger federal employee population, but the older federal employee population. I know that we have an aging workforce in the federal government, and retirements are pending. What would you say to a federal employee who may be nearing the end of his or her career and is looking to ramp up their savings or make a bit of a change in how they live their lives financially? What advice would you give them?
Many times when I talk with older federal employees, and I ask them when they want to retire from federal service, they say right away or as soon as I can. Mm-hmm. Well, I can appreciate that, but it only makes good business sense to plan for that. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you're 5 years away, you need to step back and say, what do I need to do between now and that time to make sure that I will have an income that will meet my needs? If you have a longer period than that, of course, then you have more of an opportunity to put money aside. One of the things that we've done, Jason, is to offer to federal employees what we call the Financial Freedom Report. And it's a complimentary report that takes into account what they have today in terms of their thrift savings plan, we project what their annuity will look like at the time of retirement and in the future, what the cost of federal employee group life insurance will be, and also gives them an idea as to what their thrift savings plan account will look like. The point being is that taking all of those key elements of their federal financial benefits and projecting them out in the future will give them a great idea as to what that future will look like. And if they're not in a position, or if they don't like the answers, maybe they're going to have to make some adjustments. Maybe they won't be able to retire exactly when they wanted to, or they can take some steps now that will allow them to catch up or make sure that they've taken care of certain aspects of their financial plan for the future.
And regardless of one's age, it's never too late to start contributing, start saving. Is that right?
It is never too late, Jason, and I think there's hope for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage all of your listeners to really take some action. Additional dollars in savings, making sure that they've taken care of risk. In other words, having the adequate insurance they need, whether that's for their home or for renters, making sure that they've got those key but fundamental steps in place. And, of course, again, back to planning for retirement, making sure that they're participating in the Thrift Savings Plan.
Tell us a little bit more about the Financial Freedom Report. When did this come about? What started the initiative?
We've been offering the Financial Freedom Report for over 2 years now, and it's become highly popular with the federal employee community because we saw a real need for them to realize what they had or didn't have as they planned for retirement. My experience in working with federal agencies is that the Human Resources Department really doesn't want to spend a lot of time with each employee in planning for their retirement or telling them what their retirement may look like until they're 5 years or less from retiring from federal service. And I can appreciate the demands that are placed on the agencies to take care of all of their employees. But you have to ask yourself, if you're doing that financial planning with 5 years or less before you really want to retire, are you doing yourself a favor? That's where we've stepped in with the Financial Freedom Report, again, a complimentary report that we offer to all federal employees.
And to that end, one would probably hope that, especially a financial advisor like yourself, that financial planning for anyone starts much earlier, from probably their first day on the job. Is that right?
Oh, I totally agree. And again, talking with human resources specialists at the agencies, again, that's an area that they tell me is a deficiency or a problem, because while they give an overview to new federal employees about their benefits, they're not in a position then to give them, and nor should they be in a position to give them specific advice as to how they can take advantage of those benefits or shortfalls that the benefits have, and especially how a federal employee at any point in their career can improve their position, with the foundation of federal benefits being the start for that improvement.
Now, all of this, trying to get your hands around it and understand all of it, can seem daunting. But on the other end of it, there's a lot of hope out there, right? There's a lot to look forward to. There should be a lot of optimism for what the future holds, assuming that one plans correctly. Is that right?
I think there's great reason to be optimistic about the future. And I'll give you a quick example. During the economic turndown a couple of years ago, many companies stopped contributing money into their employees' 401k or 403b plan. The federal government never stopped contributing dollars, and there's no reason to think it will. So there's a reason right there for federal employees to realize that the federal government continues to provide them with dollars for their retirement. The annuities are not in jeopardy. There will be money when you retire in the form of an annuity or pension. Again, a great foundation of income for the future. So I think there's a lot from a federal employee benefits perspective to be positive about. And at the same time, there's only reason to think that the overall U.S. economy will continue to rebound and grow in the future. We have to be optimistic.
And if listeners have questions or would like to learn more about First Command, where can they find you?
We're located in Arlington, and our telephone number is 703-418-9360. You can also go on our website, firstcommand.com.
Excellent. Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command. Appreciate your time as always, and looking forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you to our guests this week, author Charles Stevenson, Director of Information Collection at EPA's Office of Environmental Information, Lisa Schlosser, and First Command District Advisor Bob Hill. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.